Basket mat one start to leak again.
Basket mat one open mat again.
I bet you don't forget to say I sing you. My mouth like basket, you my land be a bere.
Basket mouth, one open mouth again. Ooh,
ooh, ooh. Basket mouth, one start to leak again. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Basket mouth, one open mouth again. Ooh, ooh,
ooh. I bet you don't forget to say I sing you.
Is Fela Kuti's Beasts of No Nation. He's a Nigerian musician, or was rather, who is known throughout the world music community for a lot of things. And we're going to be talking about world music today. It's a complicated bit of terminology. I mean, the world is a big place, and what we call world music and what we just call music, what's the difference there? I want to bring in an ethnomusicologist perspective on this. We've got Stephanie Shanakan on the line with us from the University of Missouri in Columbia. Stephanie, good morning.
Good morning.
You teach a class on Fela Kuti at the University of Missouri. What makes you want to teach about this musician in particular?
Well, I teach a world music class, and Fela is a prominent part of that class, as well as being a prominent part of some of the other classes I teach. I think it's important for all our students to understand that that there are music canons that we like to promote, especially in schools of music, and that those music canons should be expanded, and that there are masters of music all over the world. And somebody like Fela Kuti, who we would typically think of as being a world music musician, is actually also a genius. He's a music maker who created lots of waves with his kind of music, very, very political, very socially conscious, and really transcended the borders of the nation state that we call Nigeria.
Tell us a little bit more about him and his story for those who aren't familiar with it.
Certainly. Fela Kuti was, in fact, his full name is Fela Anikulapo Kuti, but he's best known as Fela Kuti because that's quite a mouthful. He was a Nigerian musician, artist, who in the 1960s and 70s was inspired by not only Miles Davis, the Black Panthers, and the political ideology from African Americans, but also by his mother, who was a very strong advocate for women's rights in Nigeria. And so he put all this political energy into the music he created, which was called Afrobeat. And basically his lyrics and his musical philosophy was all about challenging white supremacy, challenging colonialism and political corruption, and inspiring and empowering Black identity, and particularly African identity and self-esteem.
You mentioned the influence that people like the Black Panthers had on Fela Kuti, and it's interesting because one of the things that arises when you discuss world music and some of the possible problems with that label is the idea of sort of like a kind of cultural purity, the idea that one group, maybe that there might be something problematic about appropriating influences from another culture. And it's interesting to me that we have this African musician, this African artist creating his own genre that is influenced both by African traditions and by American traditions. Do you hear that in the music itself too?
Oh, certainly. I remember reading one of my favorite stories about Fela was James Brown came to Nigeria back in the 70s. He visited the shrine, which is where Fela Kuti would play his music. And James Brown was thrown off. He said, wow, that's the African James Brown. And I'm quite sure Fela would say the opposite. He would look at James Brown and say, well, that's the African Fela Kuti. But what's interesting to me, coming back to your question, is that, yes, we tend to think of this as Fela borrowing from outside, but really what we like to argue as African-American, as specialists in African-American music and culture, is that there has been a borrowing and a mixing and a sharing of approaches to music making across the Black diaspora, so that when we hear Fela and we think of James Brown or we think of Miles Davis, we should actually be understanding that they are all pulling from the same roots of Black music. You know, where does African American music come from? Well, it comes from the traditions that were brought over during the slave trade, and those traditions are still alive and well in Africa as well. So, I don't think that is a contradiction. I think it's very logical.
How would you define world music?
I would define world music as music of the world. I mean, I think that the industry, the music industry and radio tend to want to put music in categories, and world music then becomes what they think of as a sensible category to lump everything else. You know, it reminds me of a book that I read when I was an undergrad. It's called The West and the Rest of Us. And we always tend to think that the West is priority and the rest of the world then gets lumped in, whether we're talking about politics or economics or sociology or history, and the same thing happens with the music. So the music in industry has somehow put all the other kinds of music into one category, and that's why it's so problematic. You know, that's what we have. That's the structure that we have to work with. In academia, we often have to work with these classifications and then try to ask our students or encourage them to rethink those borders. So yes, I do teach a class called World Music. Yes, it is a class in the School of Music. And I'm glad it's there. But once the students get there, I want them to rethink how we consider all these world's musics, and also put American music in there as well, so that we see that it's all the world's musics. It's not just the most distant, the most furthest away, the most exotic. It is music that is very close to us in so many ways.
You talked about that it's sort of necessary in academia to put labels on things, but I think that can extend to industry and sales as well. I mean, is this partly a marketing term?
Certainly. I completely agree with you. I teach a class called Introduction to Soul and Country Music. And we also talk about these markets, because when we're thinking about soul and country music, we're really talking about two markets, a white market and a black market, a rural white market and an urban black market. So the industry, you know, and we talk about this in class a lot. What does the industry need to do? It needs to find very well-defined markets that they can apply advertising to, that they can focus on, that they can go after. And that's what the industry has done. And this has been happening for a long, long time. When Berry Gordy started Motown, he knew there was a market, and he knew that he had to cater to a particular market. He was looking for a mainstream appeal. And so I think every music industry mogul, even radio formats are created to continue these classifications. And if you talk to the artists themselves, they are uncomfortable. They are uncomfortable with these kinds of categories that have been placed on them. Oftentimes they have trouble talking about what genre they fit into. They all like to be more fluid. in terms of how they should be seen. But that's what academia does, and that's what the industry does.
Well, so we've addressed some of the problems, and we'll get into more of them shortly. But I am curious what, if you were going to try to identify the characteristics of world music, as huge and sprawling of a genre as that is, what might be some of the things you'd consider? I think about, for example, like singing in a language other than English, which points to, in some ways, that when we talk about world music, maybe we're talking about who is the audience, in that if we're saying that they're singing in not English and that's part of it, then that's to say I speak English and this isn't my language. But would you say that that's a part of it?
No, I would disagree with that one. Although I see where you're coming from. If I were to come up with maybe the main characteristic that I would want to put across on how we should think of world music, I would say it is the music that represents different cultures. So, for example, I'm from Nigeria. English is our first language. Fela spoke English. I mean, it was his. It's our national language. I shouldn't say it's our first language, but it is our national language. So if Fela is singing in English or Pidgin English, that is still a representation of his culture. And if we apply language to it, then it becomes very difficult to include songs from Scotland, songs from if we're using English as the standard, which of course is an issue, then we will have to exclude all the beautiful bluegrass that comes from the mountains here in West Virginia. So I would say language should be considered only as it is part of the culture of the music. So what is world music? It is the music that represents each culture around the world.
Sticking with language for just a second, I mean, in the clip we just heard from Beasts of No Nation, there are two languages in there. There's also another language in the background, that I've heard that if you speak this other language, if you're from Nigeria, you might be picking up on a lot of wordplay that you would miss out on as an English-speaking listener.
Very true, very true. So Fela always used Pidgin English, which is a combination of different local languages, and English, which is a rather subversive technique, right? What he's done there is that he's chosen to use a language again that represents his culture, which is Niger, and he chooses to identify not only as a Yoruba man, which is his own indigenous group, but also as a Nigerian. And he knows that Pidgin English is the language that is spoken by all Nigerians, or many Nigerians across ethnic lines. So what he's done there is that he's used Queen's English, but he has taken the version that the Queen can't understand, the Queen of England can't understand, and he's communicating with his people. And I think that that's something that's really powerful, so that if you are not Nigerian or from other parts of West Africa, you may not understand what Fela is doing, but we all do. So again, that's a representation of who we are as a people. And so that's how I would think about it.
That brings up for me whether politics is part of what you would consider world music.
Absolutely, absolutely. Particularly for Africans, music is an integral part of our lives, right? So we hear music when there's a funeral. There's music when there's a naming ceremony. There's music when there is somebody's turning 50. There's music when you're working. If women are in a village pounding yam, it's rhythmic. So if they're in a city, there is music there too. So there is music everywhere. So if we have to, we Africans don't remove music from our everyday lives. And if politics is a part of our everyday lives, music is going to is going to involve that, it will fold the politics into the expression of our lives through song. And this goes back to the griots of old. You know, many West African countries had griots or praise singers. Different communities would have that central artist or musician who would walk around or move around and sing praises to whatever the chief or the king is of that particular community. But they would also be that critical lens too, able to critique the histories of the realities of what is going on. And that's sort of the tradition that Fela embodied, and that's the tradition that has that we see many years later and many miles away in hip hop. So it's a tradition that really cuts across, and so politics sits very well in world music, whether it's in Africa or in different parts of the world.
I'm curious what you would think are some of, we've identified just the problem of categorizing musicians in and of itself. What are some other problems with the label world music? Appropriation comes up a lot, and I wonder if you can explain that one.
Yes. Okay. So there are several really, really prominent cases of this. And the first one that comes to mind, of course, is Paul Simon and Ladysmith Black Mambazo. I think it's a 30-year anniversary of Graceland, when Paul Simon worked with the South African group, their group of male singers who embody a subgenre called Mbube. It's a singing genre where these men would come out with these big, huge, beautiful voices and lay harmonies down. And so Paul Simon was definitely attracted to that sound, and he worked with them to create his groundbreaking album called Graceland.
Well, let's hear, let's go ahead and hear just a little bit from that album.
Sure.
And I think people are familiar with it, but in case they're not, then they'll know what we're talking about, and we'll come right back. We're going to hear at least the beginning of the song, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, a popular favorite from Paul Simon's Graceland.
Awa, 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 utshaye lekele kanjani.
Awa, awa,
kodwa esintsukwini sanamhlanje.
Awa, awa,
sibona kwenzeka kanjani.
Awa, awa,
amantombazane ayazuka.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket.
Empty
as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing
ta-na-na,
ta-na-na, ta-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
So, Stephanie, a little more about this story. I mean, Paul Simon took a trip to South Africa. How did he end up working with these musicians?
It's an interesting story because at the time, of course, it was still, South Africa was still under apartheid, and you know, there were very complicated relationships between South Africa, the South African government, South African people, and these Western artists. And over a period of many years, there were many artists who would not go to South Africa in support of the people and in a way trying to make a statement against the apartheid South African government. But Paul Simon found a way to work with this group. I don't know what the particulars of how he contacted them or how he got in touch with them, but what we do know is that it resulted in this fabulous album. And the complication then comes with half the fans loving this, right? So people love this album. They love that Paul Simon, of course, has by this time he's gone solo from his from his duo group, Simon and Garfunkel, also a big favorite of mine. And in his solo career, he's creating all these really wonderful, interesting sounds with a group like Ladysmith Black Mambazo. So we love that. But then the other question is, well, Paul Simon made a lot of money from this album. His prominence grew even more after he won all the awards for this album. Questions about, well, how much did he pay the group? Was he just using them? Those kinds of questions. But again, anybody who has sort of followed that story and watched some of the footage from Paul Simon working with the group will see that that there was some people might read it as agency, that that the group had agency to choose to work with Paul Simon. Another thing to consider is that this group then got its own prominence having worked with Paul Simon.
Yeah, they're still touring today.
They are, and they actually won an award on their own the following year or a couple of years later. So do we punish Paul Simon? I don't know what the word is, but are we upset with him for bringing so much attention to such a wonderful group?
Stephanie Shonikon, excuse me, stay with us. We're going to bring in a couple of local musicians on this discussion about whether appropriation is a problem in world music. We'd love to hear from you, too. If you love world music, we'd like to hear about the appeal for you. 816-235-2888. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's big question is, what is world music? And is calling something that in any way problematic? We've heard so far from Stephanie Shonikon with us from the University of Missouri in Columbia. Let's turn now to Gerald Trimble. He's a Kansas City musician leading a session at this week's Folk Alliance conference on bluegrass as world music. Hi, Gerald.
Thank you, Gina.
First of all, how do you define world music?
Well, I think it's a big definition, and I think that Stephanie answered a lot of questions that I might have addressed in a very similar way, except as a working musician and an international musician who plays all over the world and has been influenced by different types of music. My history comes from Kansas City, and then I went out into the world when I was very young and learned at the time what was world music to us, which was Celtic music, and gradually spent many years traveling in Eastern countries, especially Turkish, and developing deep relationships with instruments and cultures that we call today world music. The music I play today is a type of music that is a combination of all of these on an instrument called viola da gamba, which is a stringed instrument from the Renaissance and Baroque eras, and I play original instruments. And so I combine early music and instruments with several different cultures. So this is a form of music that cannot be really categorized in, as you said, the commercial necessity of putting things in boxes. So world music is a very, very good category or general balloon for a lot of types of music that, as you might say, are other from the perspective of the West. But remember that from the East, we're the other. So it's a difficult thing to say, and yet it's a good category. I also include in that music that is a fusion. We talked about a cultural appropriation, and that's a big subject. But you have to remember that there is very little music in the world that is not influenced by other musics. And one of those points to bring up is how it's done and why it's done. And I would like to see, to add to Stephanie's great comments there, the idea that the best form of knowing of traditional music is to spend time in the culture and to do it. There are many records that have world beat that people take ideas from other cultures without having spent any time in those cultures. I would prefer to hear a musician who's gone there and spent the time with the masters, because most of the world music that we discuss here, the music of Africa, the music of the Middle East, the music of Ireland, they're all lineages. They're passed from someone to someone. Even if you learn it off of records, at some point you have to come in contact with a master from somewhere else. And this is one of the reasons that we call it a tradition.
You know, have you ever in your travels as what appears to be a white man from the United States, learning the musical traditions of other countries and other cultures, have you ever encountered some of the conflicts that we were just talking about in Paul Simon's Graceland, sort of just even internally, like that maybe a political lack of even-footedness perhaps between you and the people you're interacting with, or just a sense of what belongs to you versus what belongs to them? Has that ever influenced how you approach someone or how you approach something?
I've always approached every musician I went to with respect and sought to learn from them. In my younger days, I was probably a little bit more enthusiastic and maybe a little bit more difficult because of my enthusiasm. But the only thing that could ever happen like that was in the early days when an American tried to play Irish music or Scottish music to some degree in the 70s and 80s, it was still a little unusual. And I had to be careful in the early days with the records I put out, what kind of material I put on there. Johnny Cunningham.
Visually?
No. The music.
Oh, okay.
Johnny Cunningham was a wonderful Scottish fiddler who passed away some years ago, and he was my producer, and he was very careful to help me select material that would bridge that gap. So, no, I never had any problem other than just the difficulties of different cultures and how they relate in the sense of we might say something wrong and not know it. In Indian music that I studied, it was only learning their traditions, learning what not to do, what to do, and some of the sensitivities of my Indian master, who's a disciple of Ravi Shankar, in how to approach him and how to show respect. Westerners have to learn that. And in Turkey, in those places, mainly, most of those people were so glad that people were interested that other than the basic cultural differences, I've had very little problem.
I want to bring Enrique Chi on this. He's from the band Making Movies, a Kansas City band. Enrique is a local guy. He is Panamanian by birth and Kansas Cityan by his current existence. And Enrique, I wonder what you think about all of this.
You know, the whole time I've been listening, everybody's had really great points. And I think that there's one thing that hasn't been mentioned is that we've been discussing the business and the art form and flipping between the two things back and forth. And I feel like it's important to make a division. When we talked about Paul Simon's Graceland album, no one has mentioned a problem with the music. And I think because it's pretty much universally accepted that it was a brilliant album. It's, you know, combining a Western folk songwriting styles with African rhythms was a brilliant idea. When we started discussing the issues with appropriation, we were discussing business issues. And Paul Simon has specifically with that album, he has a kind of a bad reputation of being a little bit ruthless as a businessman. And I think that that's where the backlash came from, as people found out that he was potential, you know, obviously this is all based on people's opinion, but that potentially he was not quite so gracious as a businessman when it came to dividing up how that album should receive recognition. And I actually, because my producer, Steve Berlin, he at Los Lobos played on Graceland. I kind of know a little bit of the backside of the story. And I think there's definitely some reason to maybe complain about Paul Simon's business dealings. But I think as the art form, I think any artist that is inspired by something else and chooses to create artwork with the intention of making something beautiful, I don't see how there's any problem with that. I only think that that's wonderful. As long as the intention of the attitude is I want to learn. And I think that human beings can really perceive that. I think we perceive intention far more than we give ourselves credit for.
Do you think that this is that there's a difference between how musicians approach this question and how listeners and critics and the music industry approaches this question?
I do. I believe that it's just very funny because putting labels on music is like any other cultural thing. It is only relatively true. Our band is in Kansas City, a Latin band. Maybe people put us in a category of world music or definitely eclectic, you know, ethnic something, right? People don't reference us as making movies as a rock band in Kansas City. We're so different from the rock bands. When I go to Latin America, we are definitely a rock band.
Well, Enrique, let's hear a little bit of your band so that people will get a taste, and then we'll continue discussing that, okay? We're going to hear a song called Te Estaba Buscando.
Que nadie va, ese rincón en mi ciudad, barrio derrumbado. Una niña crece antes de su edad, mira cómo sueña escapar, niña ten cuidado. A 14 años huye de su hogar, se preña y vende su libertad por un amor violado. Tiempo pasa pero nada cambiará. Es una madre soltera con corazón quebrado.
Enrique, first of all, tell us a little bit about the song we're enjoying right now.
This song is called Estaba Buscando, and it was written. It's a story about a young woman in a rough neighborhood here in Kansas City, a girl that I met when I was doing some volunteer work through the Matty Road Center. And I had a version of the song, and I decided to rewrite it about her story. And I also collaborated with a Panamanian songwriter named Amado Fano, and he helped me work out some of the lyrics and really understand how to sing the story to the clave rhythm, which the clave rhythm is the center of all Latin music, but the clave rhythm is a West African rhythm. It's taken from West African spiritual music. It's taken from this Yoruba culture that ended up through the slave trade in Latin America and became the foundation for all Latin music, and became really, in my humble opinion, it's the foundation for all Western rhythmic music, whether it's soul, funk, R&B, rock and roll, hip hop. Those West African rhythms became really the root of everything that we hear in the Americas that's rhythmic at all. With very rare exceptions of like indigenous tribes that have never had contact with other, you know, there's a few exceptions in the world of stuff that isn't already a fusion.
Is it important to you, Enrique, to represent in some way Latin American music traditions in your own creations, or is that something that I don't know that happens but isn't a deliberate or kind of necessary move from your standpoint?
To me, it's deliberate. It's very deliberate. I believe, and it actually goes deeper than Latin American. I believe that Latin music, when you put, I mean, and we're saying Latin music is already such a broad term. So if I'm going to say one specific genre of music, which is called típico in Panama, it's called cumbia in Colombia, and those terms are semi-interchangeable. That music is a mix of African chant drum music mixed with the indigenous flutes. So the native tribes in that region would have South American kind of flute music. So then it was the drums and flutes. And then at some point Europeans brought in violin. So it's drums, flutes, violin. And then at some point a German came to Colombia, the region, and brought a few accordions. And some musicians figured out that you don't have to hire someone to play a flute and violin, and actually, if you play accordion, you can also sing. So the poor flute musicians and violinists got fired, because if you got one good accordionist, you can kind of fill up just as much sound, and you have less people to pay. And then, so about 100 years ago, this music started emerging based on the African rhythms, this chant kind of call and response of African culture, Spanish poetry. The indigenous flute has now been replaced by an accordion, and it is now what Panamanians consider their folk music. They don't use that term, but they use típico, which means our typical music. That's, you know, so that's basically saying our folk music. So even that is already such an amalgamation of the human migration, you know, across history. And I just believe that music itself is an immigrant. And music itself is a fusion of culture.
That is a really interesting idea. I want to run that one past Gerald Trimble. Gerald, the idea that music itself is an immigrant, because you're teaching this, you're leading a session called Bluegrass as World Music.
Actually, I do have to correct you. It's called The Roots of Roots.
Oh.
And it's a world music panel. I'm not the moderator, but I'm a member. And that's at 1 o'clock on Saturday.
So would you say that part of, I mean, what is the main point that you are bringing with you to this session?
My really reason for sharing and a salient point that I've had for most of my musical career is that all the music is connected. One of the main reasons it's connected is through Spain, which was a conglomeration of the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim cultures. A very high civilization existed for 700 years. Through that, through the Islamic culture, all the music from China, India, Middle East, and Africa, because it was also a part of that culture, came together in a world that was open and very, very artistic. And the stringed instruments, the rhythms and songs were brought and passed into Europe. And everything we have today is a conglomeration of that.
You have a new album called Uncharted, A Viola da Gamba Adventure. What's the story behind that album? Well, very quickly, so that we can still hear a little bit of it.
This instrument represents that connection because it comes from both cultures. And I play it in a new way that makes it a world instrument. And this is a combination of music from early times early Celtic and British music mixed with Turkish and other types of music from the Middle East.
Let's give a listen to a song from Uncharted, A Viola da Gamba Adventure. So, Gerald, this is world music then?
I think it's world music in its best sense is that it combines many cultures from someone who's tried to learn from those cultures and speaks of the connections of cultures through the ages.
Stephanie Shanahan, with us from the University of Missouri in Columbia, is learning a positive in world music. We've heard so many of the complications and problems, but is a process of learning a positive?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I just have so much enjoyed what Gerald and Enrique have said. I mean, anybody who listens to these two artists will understand that these two people know what they're talking about. This is, they're laying down the context for the music that they play. They have a keen understanding of the deep history behind that music. And to me, that is a powerful thing. And when Gerald said that he prefers to listen to people who understand where the music comes from, if they're going to appropriate it, I completely agree. And that's why I'm such a big fan of people like Bonnie Raitt and Janis Joplin.
Stephanie Shanahan, thank you. And Enrique Chi and Gerald Trimble, thank you both as well.
You're welcome.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, how a grassroots organization of Mexican-American women prevented the closing of their West Side Church. Stay with us.